Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them.
Welcome to this ABC Radio National podcast. For more on other entertaining and informative programs, listen after the end for details. But right now, here's your podcast, which we hope you enjoy.
Hello, I'm Norman Swan, and you're listening to The Health Report. Today we're talking about appendages and the rude things that doctors are planning to do to them. And just to confuse you, women have these appendages too. Using heart technology in the brain and important findings in the last few days about a relatively recent way of keeping coronary arteries open. Those are the arteries that supply oxygen to the heart muscle. Now, if you think this isn't for you, you're wrong. According to the National Heart Foundation, two-thirds of Australian families have someone affected by heart disease. That's nearly 4 million Australians, about 1.5 million of whom aren't living a full life because of it. And one person dies of heart disease in Australia every 10 minutes. And for some people, it comes out of the blue at quite a young age. So you never know when you'll need the information in today's program. The study in this week's edition of the New England Journal of Medicine is about stents, tiny sleeves of metal designed to keep blocked arteries open after the narrowing has been pushed aside by a balloon catheter. Stents have revolutionized the treatment of blocked coronary arteries. The first ones were just made of bare metal, but in the last few years, so-called drug-eluting stents have come onto the market at considerable cost. They release drugs which aim to reduce the chances of an artery re-blocking or re-stenosing. About 4 years ago, the Swedish researchers involved in this week's paper compared drug-eluting to bare metal stents and had some pretty bad news about the drug-eluting ones. Associate Professor Stefan James is in the Uppsala Clinical Research Centre in Sweden.
We published an article in New England Journal of Medicine back in 2005 where we were able to investigate all patients in the country of Sweden who had received one or many drug-eluting stents and compare them to all the patients who had received only bare metal stents. And what we found in 2005 was an increase in late mortality. We saw a 30% increase in mortality on long term. Now, this created a lot of attention and interest all over the world, and people were questioning the use of drug-eluting stents. And so we said we have to go back and extend the enrollment of patients and redo the analysis after having included more patients and also after a period of time when the physicians have learned to use these devices better.
And just to explain, in fact, practice changed after your landmark paper because people realized that late clotting on these stents was a problem. These stents are really designed to stop the blood vessel narrowing down but not clotting. And Doctors started using an antiplatelet drug called clopidogrel. The question is, did that solve the problem? And then presumably that's part of the question you're trying to answer this time around.
Yeah, so since 2005, a lot of changes have occurred, I think. One of those is that we have been better in understanding the problems with clotting of these stents. So we have increased the loading doses of clopidogrel, and we have extended the duration of treatment. We can't tell definitely that this is the main cause of change, because also other things have changed. We have learned how to select patients to treat with a drug-eluting stent versus a bare metal stent. And also we have learned to use these stents properly. We have increased the balloon pressures. We have learned what vessels are suitable for drug-eluting stents.
So you've followed how many people in this registry now, and what results did you find?
Since these devices came onto the market, we have followed almost 50,000 patients, and that's all patients in the country of Sweden. We have 100% coverage, and what we found is no difference in late occurring death or myocardial infarction rates. So the outcome is similar between these two treatments, which is very reassuring for all the patients worldwide who have drug-eluting stents implanted in their coronary arteries.
And when you say myocardial infarction, you mean heart attack?
Yeah, there's no difference in death or heart attacks between the drug-eluting stents and the bare metal stents.
That might be good news for people with drug-eluting stents, but it might not be good news for insurers or governments paying for these, because they pay an awful lot more money for drug-eluting stents than they do bare metal. And if there's no difference in late events, why bother putting in a drug-eluting stent at all and save money?
Yeah, right. But we do see a reduced incidence of patients coming back with what we call restenosis. There's less renarrowing of the coronary arteries, and there's lower needs for repeated interventions and operations. They do their work. There is a lower risk for renarrowings.
But the extent of this, I think from your results, you've got to treat 40 people with a drug-eluting stent for one renarrowing to be prevented. So that's quite a lot of people being treated with
This is a very important interpretation of our study, is that for the general population, we have to treat 40 patients in order to avoid one case of renarrowing if we use the drug-eluting stents versus the bare metal stents. But if we go to patients that we know are at high risk of developing renarrowing, that number is much lower. That is patients with diabetes mellitus, patients with long lesions, long stents, and also small vessels, less than 3 millimeters in diameter. Those patients have a much greater benefit with drug-eluting stents, and the number needed to treat is only 10 as compared to 40 among the general population. So our recommendation here is to treat patients at high risk for developing re-narrowing restenosis. If the healthcare system can afford it, it's okay from a safety point of view to use drug-eluting stents in a more general, in a broader population. But both for price issues and also for safety issues, because there still is a concern about late-occurring stent thrombosis, blood clotting, I think we should reserve drug-eluting stents to patients at highest risk.
But aren't those the patients, according to recent trials, who probably shouldn't have an angioplasty at all, shouldn't have a catheter and balloon, and they should go straight to bypass because they do better on cardiac bypass?
This is a complicated issue. I think it's that the answer to this question is, if the patient has very many and complicated stenoses, many places, a lot of calcifications, curvy, difficult arteries, and many arteries are involved, patients are better off for cardiac surgery, bypass surgery. The more complicated the coronary arteries are, the better bypass surgery is. But the vast majority of patients with heart attacks and angina pectoris have less intensive or less widespread coronary disease. And most of them are suited very well for stenting. And about, I would guess, that about 30-40% of them should receive a drug-eluting stent. And the rest, maybe 60-70% of them, do very well with bare metal stents.
What proportion of people... You only studied people who got one stent in, so one drug-eluting versus one bare metal. What proportion of people on average get more than one stent in, and what were the figures for them?
We studied both patients who received one stent and patients who received many stents. About one-third of the patients in Sweden received just one stent, and about two-thirds of them received several stents. And the results are basically the same for both these groups of patients.
How many is the maximum number of stents that can go in at any one time, just as a matter of interest?
There's no clear limit how many stents you can put in, but it's definitely clear that the more stents you put in and the more complicated you do the operation, the more likely it is for the patients to come back with a new stenosis or with new chest pain or new heart attacks. So I think a lesson that we have learned is to keep it simple. We should really try to put in as few stents as possible and to use short stents if possible.
Now, did you take into account the costs of clopidogrel? Clopidogrel is not a cheap drug. The pharmaceutical company that makes it is making a lot of money out of this drug because it's being used all over the place. And surgeons hate it. The reason surgeons hate clopidogrel is that it lasts a long time. It knocks out the platelets for a long time. And if you need repeat surgery or you've had a stent in and you need to go in and do a bypass, you can't do that urgently, or it's very hard to do it because you have a patient who will bleed. So did you take into account
total effects, like people who knocked their head on Plavix and ended up in hospital with a bleed, or in other words, people who got into problems, and the costs of the clopidogrel itself?
In our study, we only analyzed mortality. So if bleeding events led to mortality, that was included.
What's the risks of clopidogrel, and what data do we have post-marketing of the risks versus benefits, given that this is a drug that, whilst the very few side effects, the actual effect of the drug on the platelets is profound and lasts quite a long time if you get into strife, particularly surgically?
Yes, I think it's a very good question, important issue that you're bringing up. Clopidogrel is not a perfect drug for several reasons. It's effective in most, but not all of the patients, first of all. Only about 3/4 of the patients have the effect that we want clopidogrel to have. So that's one problem. The other problem is that it's very difficult to get rid of the effect of the drug. So if the patients need surgery, it's a problem with bleeding. So we would like to have drugs that wean off quicker and are more effective in more patients. Still, clopidogrel is an important drug when we're treating patients with previous heart attacks and patients who have been stented. But when we treat these patients, we have to make sure that the patients can tolerate the medicine and that they're actually taking it. And therefore, I think we should be careful in treating patients with drug-eluting stents, patients who are older, patients who may need some surgery in the near future. We should be a little bit careful. In our study, patients received clopidogrel for 3 to 12 months generally, and when they were treated as such, the mortality was unaffected in the drug-eluting stent versus the Behrmuth stent group. So from this study, there's no reason to recommend a longer duration of clopidogrel treatment. Most of the stent thrombosis, the blood clotting occurs early, and the longer you wait, the lower the risk for blood clotting. My message is that from a safety point of view, drug-eluting stents used in a general broad population is okay. From an efficacy point of view, you should try to treat primarily patients at high risk for developing re-narrowings, such as patients with diabetes with long stenosis in their coronary arteries, and patients with very narrow arteries.
Associate Professor Stefan James is in the Uppsala Clinical Research Centre in Sweden. And you're listening to The Health Report here on ABC Radio National. Now, that work couldn't have been done had it not been for the nationwide registry of cardiac procedures in Sweden. There's been argy-bargy for years in Australia about having a cardiac procedures registry, documenting people who are having things like stents to see how they go. Such procedures are a huge part of the healthcare budget. They're high risk and could be involving technology or products that may not work as well as doctors think. A cardiac procedures register seems like a no-brainer, but it's only now that we're in Australia creeping towards it. One place with a registry like this is the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Chet Rehal is Professor of Medicine and Director of Cardiac Catheterization at the Mayo Clinic.
Coronary angioplasty, which means opening blockages in the arteries with a balloon, was first started and invented by Dr. Grunzig in Switzerland in the late 1970s. The first angioplasty was performed here at Mayo Clinic in 1979. And from patient number one till the present day, we've enrolled every single patient into a prospective registry, which means we follow them and annually we contact them to see how they're doing, to see whether or not they're well, whether or not they're active, or if they've had any hospitalizations or heart attacks or needed surgery, any problems. And the reason for this is, how do you know whether or not you're doing a good job unless you know? And the only way to know is to ask your patients. If you simply are doing procedures and never seeing your patient again, I'm afraid you would never know what your results are and you would never know how to improve them.
And the scary thing is that whilst some cardiologists will collect them for their own patients, it's haphazard and not necessarily 100% of everybody that's going through the procedure.
This is, again, a very important point. You have to have 100% catchment. I think this is one of the most important things that we did in the cath lab, every single patient that's enrolled. So for a country, for example, of the size of Australia, I'm sure the cardiovascular component of your healthcare budget is always under scrutiny. In most countries, cardiovascular diagnostics and therapeutics consume a large proportion of the healthcare budget.
And we don't know what we're getting for it.
Exactly. How do we know you're getting value for your money unless you can actually demonstrate what the results are? So, for example, if you treat 10,000 patients, you follow them for 5 years and they're having excellent results, perhaps that's a good spend of money. On the other hand, If most of them are coming back and having other problems, then either you're doing something wrong or you need better procedures or better devices. But this is the only way you would know.
So when the Swedes came out with their original findings about the potential risks of blood clots on drug-eluting stents, the cardiologists at the Mayo Clinic were immediately able to check their own results based on their registry of over 27,000 people who've had a cardiac procedure and been followed every year. Chet Rehal again.
So one of the first things we did is we went to our registry and we looked up what the one-year results were of the first 1,000 patients we had implanted a drug-eluting stent into. Within the first 2 years of the release of drug-eluting stents, we actually had a good handle on what problems we were experiencing, if any. And what we found was that the thrombosis or blood clot rate was only 0.9%. In other words, if you had one of the stents, there was a 99% chance you would not have a blood clot. We then went and looked at those specific cases, and we've determined what the reasons were. But it was the presence of the registry being able to track our patients that allowed us to develop a confidence level that we were doing a good job for our patients and that these stents were, in fact, safe.
In Australia, there's been a register of artificial hips and artificial knees, which has induced a remarkable change of behavior on the part of orthopedic surgeons. It's run by orthopedic surgeons for orthopedic surgeons, and they've moved away from hip joints that have been, or knee joints that have proved less reliable to more reliable ones. That must be surely the case in cardiac interventions. Some of the kit that you're using is better than others. Has that happened with the registry?
It has. Some years ago, we had a treatment called brachytherapy, which means radiation treatment. One of the things we used to do is if a patient came back with a re-blockage, we used to open it with a balloon and then put in radioactive beads that actually would radiate the artery, thereby preventing blockages from coming back yet again. Now, what we didn't realize at first is that it would also prevent the normal lining of these arteries from growing in. And we discovered that these patients were at higher risk of developing blood clots years later.
Have you been able to determine then what are the key factors which determine whether somebody does well or badly overall in your registry?
This is a great question. It's a fallacy to think that putting in one stent in one segment of the artery will magically forestall any events in the future. One thing we've learned from our registry is that the more cardiac medications we have patients on after one of these PCI or angioplasty procedures, the better they do.
There's things like cholesterol-lowering, blood pressure-lowering.
Exactly. Cholesterol-lowering medications, blood pressure-lowering medications, antiplatelet drugs like aspirin, and sometimes ACE inhibitors as well. These are very, very important. Now, what the patients can do, and obviously the patients have to be active participants in their care, is to make sure that they've got their risk factors controlled as much as possible.
Does your register tell you how many of these procedures a cardiologist has got to do before he or she gets good at it?
We've tried to look at that. You know, for new devices, there is definitely what we call a learning curve. And that learning curve depends on the complexity of the new device.
It's one of the things that's really important for patients. How many do you need to be doing a year to stay good? I mean, those are this volume question is really important, independent of the hospital and whether the hospital is good at it.
I think the first thing is patients should feel comfortable asking their physicians how many procedures they do and what their results are.
What's the magic number?
I'm not sure there is a magic number. The national recommendations are a minimum of 75 angioplasty procedures per year, but I'm not sure that's a magic number. In general, Norman, the more procedures you do, the better you will get at them.
And the complication rate? What's the magic number there?
The complication rate in modern practice for elective angioplasty, the mortality risk, the risk to a person's life, should be less than 1%. The heart attack complication rate should only be 2 or 3%. And the emergency bypass rate should be much less than 1%. So the major complications that we worry about in aggregate should really be less than 5%.
And you need to ask your specialist if those are actually his or her figures, or are they quoting other people's experience on average? And if they're not their figures, why aren't they keeping them? This all begs the question of whether you need a stent in the first place, because a major trial we covered on the Health Report last year suggested that in many cases of people who have chest pain when they exercise, good drug treatment can do just as well. And more recently, there's been evidence that in some people, coronary artery bypass surgery is better than stents in the medium to long run. Chet Rehal.
In my view, these treatments are often complementary rather than mutually exclusive. One, and the most important indication, is to make the patient feel better. If a patient's symptoms can be controlled with medications and they're living a full and active lifestyle, then I think that's fine. That's a good therapeutic endpoint.
The problem is, a person comes in with their first episode of angina, the GP then sends that person to a cardiologist who then does fancy testing, and they're in the hands of the person then who does the stenting. There's an enormous conflict of interest. So it's not quite as simple as you're saying.
Let me just continue with the other two reasons. And what you're just pointing out is a real phenomenon, so we have to avoid that temptation. Now, over and above symptom control, there are some other good reasons for recommending procedures. One of them is to try to improve a patient's life expectancy. There are certain subsets of patients, particularly those with what we call left main disease or three-vessel coronary artery disease.
These are the arteries which are affected by the blockage.
Exactly, where we feel that if they have bypass surgery, that their chances of living longer will be better with bypass surgery. Even if their symptoms are perfectly controlled by the GP, there may still be some proportion of patients that benefit from bypass surgery. Similarly, there are some patients where you put them on a treadmill and you'll see that their heart gets extremely ischemic or short of blood. And those patients likely will benefit from having a stent or bypass surgery. So symptoms are number one. Number two is the risk profile of the patient. Now, what we're not good at is number three, which is to try to prevent heart attacks in the future. And it's really important for all of us who practice cardiology and for our patients to realize the things that prevent heart attacks are actually the medications. It's not the stents or the bypass surgery, it's the medications. So they're actually complementary and not exclusive in that type of situation.
Chet Rehal is Professor of Medicine and Director of Cardiac Catheterization at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Another area where the Mayo is at the leading edge is looking after people with problems with the way their hearts beat. They have abnormal rhythm which needs to be fixed electrically, say with a pacemaker. I spoke to three of their electrophysiology team, that's the specialty involved, Charles Bruce, Sam Asarvatham and Paul Friedman. One of their potential new therapies is using keyhole surgery around the outside of the heart, inside the shrink wrap that surrounds it, to prevent strokes in sometimes quite young people. To understand what's going on though, a lesson in heart electrics from Paul Friedman.
Sure. So the electrical signals of the heart coordinate its mechanical activity. And the heartbeat starts in the top chambers called the atria and spreads out. An analogy would be dropping a pebble in a quiet pond. The waves spread out, cause the top chambers to contract. And then the electrical signals spread to the bottom chambers called the ventricles, which are the main pumps, which then squeeze and circulate blood to the lungs and to the rest of the body.
Now, sometimes these top chambers, the atria, quiver. It's a bit like chucking lots of pebbles into the pond, so the pumping's chaotic and ineffective. What can happen then is that blood clots develop in a pouch leading off the atrium. That pouch is called the atrial appendage. The risk then is that the clots break out of the appendage and go to the brain, leading to a stroke, which is why people with atrial fibrillation are given anticoagulants. But that's not risk-free. Charles Bruce.
Yeah, and the problem about anticoagulants is the most commonly used one is warfarin, and that has a narrow therapeutic index, and by that I mean too much causes too much bleeding and the risk of bleeding complications, too little, and you don't eliminate the risk of a thrombus or clot formation. And so the patients require very meticulous attention to the level of warfarin in their blood. Furthermore, older patients who are frail, who may be at risk of falling, pose a particular risk if they're on warfarin anticoagulation, and so they may, in fact, not be able to benefit from that treatment. And it's for this reason that non-pharmacologic or non-drug treatments to prevent stroke are so important.
What they're developing at the Mayo Clinic is a keyhole technique to tie off the atrial appendage where the clots gather. So do people with atrial fibrillation have larger ones than usual? Sam Asarvatham.
Yes, the left atrial appendage and the left atrium itself routinely enlarges in people with atrial fibrillation. Part of it is what causes atrial fibrillation is high pressures in the ventricle, and that gets transmitted to the atrium.
As if you've got, say, heart failure.
Heart failure or long-standing high blood pressure. So it's not uncommon to have an appendage that's about 50% bigger than normal. This treatment consists of going into the pericardial space, the covering around the heart, and getting a suture to be placed around the neck of the atrial appendage so that if blood clots were to form in this appendage, it no longer can get into the circulation or produce a stroke.
So effectively, it's like tying the neck on a paper bag.
It's exactly like that. It no longer can contribute to the arrhythmia process, and the body just fibroses the structure, so it becomes scar tissue.
And what this appendage, Paul, is part of the problem in atrial fibrillation of the abnormal electrical conductivity?
Yes, it is. It's part of the atrial tissue, and it contributes to the abnormal electrical activity, and more importantly is that it is the primary source where clots may form and cause stroke.
So you've done experiments in animals to date?
That's correct. And we've seen that it closes off, it stays closed, and what had been this very complex chamber, like a series of small caves almost, just forms a smooth barrier where there had been this complex structure, and it's no longer part of the circulation.
And does it help the atrial fibrillation?
That's not known yet.
So first human experiments when, Sam?
July or August will be the first in human experiments.
Sam Asirvatham, and before him, Paul Friedman. Now, there are tens of thousands of Australians walking around with a pacemaker, a little box of electronics which sits in the chest with wires or leads going to the heart muscle. The pacemaker is there to fix up an abnormally slow heartbeat, or could be a defibrillator to shock the heart if it goes into a life-threatening rhythm. Usually there are two pacing wires, one of which is screwed into the right atrium, the upper chamber, and the second goes through the valve, the tricuspid valve, and snares into the tip of the right ventricle. The electrophysiology team at the Mayo Clinic is also innovating new pacemaker design, and Charles Bruce explains why.
In the scenario you've described, that would then restore the contraction of both the top chambers or the atria with the ventricles or the bottom chambers. Investigators at Mayo have looked at patients who have had pacemaker leads and also defibrillator leads, and sometimes even both, and these leads are stiff and they may have a wider caliber and may be inadvertently traumatized the tricuspid leaflets, resulting in a perforation or a malfunction. They may also splint the tricuspid leaflets, again allowing the tricuspid valve not to work properly.
So Sam, you've found a way of pacing the ventricle from the atrium.
Yes. Traditional thinking is to pace the ventricle, you have to cross the valve that separates the atrium from the ventricle. But there is a portion of the ventricle muscle tissue that's directly in continuity with the atrium, and that's called the atrioventricular septum. So we've devised a special lead that can be placed into this portion of the heart, so you don't have to cross the tricuspid valve. And it turns out, since we're pacing the ventricular septum, which is like a curtain between the right and left ventricle, we wind up stimulating both ventricles, much like the normal heart.
So in theory, Paul, then, it's a much more natural form of stimulation.
It is. In our acute animal studies, we've looked at both the electrical effects and the mechanical effects, as opposed to traditional places at the tip of the heart. And we found that the ventricles contracted in a much more coordinated manner, in a much more effective and natural manner. There is at least some suggestion in our early findings that possibly it may help people who have a weak heart pump, and that part of that weakness is from discoordinated electrical activity.
So Charles, how long before this gets tested in humans?
We're in the process of conducting some additional acute experiments to better design the lead tip to ensure that it has the structural integrity to withstand long-term use. And I would imagine within the next 2 years that we'll be able to start using this in human trials.
So Sam, tell me about this last one where you're trying to pace the brain.
So right now, if you had someone from Mars come and visit and you tell them I'm an electrophysiologist, they will assume you deal with the brain, because 99% of the electrical activity in the body is the brain. But cardiac electrophysiology has advanced tremendously to where we hardly ever need open chest surgery. Brain electrophysiology is relatively primitive, where to treat seizures without drugs, you have to open the skull and remove a part of brain tissue that's causing seizures. We have an innovation where we use specially designed sheaths and leads similar to what's done and effective in the heart, but modified to place through the veins to get to the bad brain tissue to either stimulate it to prevent, say, some diseases like depression or Parkinson's disease, or to ablate or buzz or burn that tissue to get rid of seizures, maybe tumors, or malformations in the arterial system.
So how different is this from the deep brain stimulation that people are doing already for Parkinson's disease?
The principle is identical, but with presently existing systems, you have to do an open surgical procedure to place the lead. Here we place the lead through the veins that drain the brain. No scar, no need for surgery.
And where are you at with the research here?
We've progressed through various animal models of testing, to now primate studies where we've shown that you can reach the brain tissue through the veins, you can ablate, you can pace and stimulate.
Sam Esarvatham, Charles Bruce and Paul Friedman all work in cardiovascular medicine at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, which is where I interviewed them not so long ago. I'm being Norman Swan, and you've been listening to the Health Report here on ABC Radio National. You can hear us twice each week, 8:30 on Monday mornings and at 1:30 on Tuesday mornings. But you can hear us anytime you like by going to our website, and that's abc.net.au/rn/health report, and just go and find out how to download a podcast or audio stream or even read a transcript, and our transcripts now go back many years indeed. Don't forget the ABC's health and wellbeing website, that's abc.net.au/health.
That was Norman Swan in Australian Broadcasting Corporation's podcast of the Health Report in May this year. At the halfway mark, it's time to take a break in the show. We'll listen to Sonny Lance Slim, his track, A Blues Improvisation.
Right back to the old country.
This show has run into increasing difficulty arranging interviews with media reps who seem to take forever to set up an interview with a contact on the topic that we've chosen for an interview. This week was no different. Unfortunately, a major Canadian organization took half a week to arrange to getting us a phone number so that we could talk to another media rep. and get a phone number. We probably won't be dealing with media reps in the future, just to let you know that you're getting the story straight from the horse's mouth and not a doctored version for the media. Now we're going to the print media, our review of the weekly news. Remember, these are excerpts from stories and not the stories themselves. And for the actual stories, you'd go to the media that we name on the show and the writers whose names we give for the stories that we summarize. We've been following this for three newscasts. Unique program for children with learning issues revived. This is from The Globe by Kate Hammer. A unique program for learning disabled pupils was resurrected after being axed by government-appointed supervisors for the Toronto Catholic District School Board. The Arrowsmith program was cancelled in June as part of an effort to balance the school board's budget. The program costs the board about $200,000 a year, and parents question the merit of cutting what they see as a highly successful program to save such a small amount. They began efforts to challenge the decision in court and became cautiously hopeful that it might be reversed late last month after the supervisors resigned and were replaced by Richard Alway, president of the University of Toronto's Pontifical Institute of Medieval Studies and chairman of the C.D. Howe Memorial Foundation. Parents of Arrowsmith students received a letter from Dr. Alway informing them that he had decided to grandfather the program to children who were already in it when it was canceled. I wish to make it clear that I am confident that the rationale behind the decision was at the time aligned with the best use of human fiscal resources, Dr. Alway wrote to parents. However, in the interests of the least disruptive arrangements for students currently participating in the Arrowsmith program, I've decided to continue the provision of the program for these students until the end of the 2011-12 school year, when the Arrowsmith program in the schools of the TCDSB, Toronto Catholic District School Board, will cease. And from The Globe, Saturday, September 12th, this by Kirk Macon, Justice Reporter. Legal aid boycott now affects entire province. Four remaining regions join protest of eroding fee structure, with 700 criminal lawyers refusing to accept serious cases. A boycott of the Ontario legal aid plan enveloped the province for the first time, as criminal lawyers in four remaining regions repudiated a government injection of $60 million into the struggling program's annual budget. The added support of defense lawyers from Ottawa, Brockville, Halton, and Niagara regions came 4 days after Attorney General Chris Bentley proposed the budget increase to take effect in stages over the next 4 years. I regret that the program has become so discredited in the legal community, but there is no point in pretending it hasn't reached that point, said Frank Dario, president of the Criminal Lawyers Association. If the problem is not solved during this crisis, my sense is that a two-tier system will get irretrievably established. That would be a real step backward for the justice system. Criminal Lawyers Association leaders welcomed the proposed increase to the $300 million program, but said it's not enough to attract experienced lawyers back to the plan. The highest rate a senior lawyer can be paid currently is $97 an hour. Sarah Wunsch, chairperson of the Family Lawyers Association, said the FLA is also firmly opposed to block fees. Under a block fee system, lawyers are paid a set amount for particular legal services, regardless of how much time and effort they expend on a case. When someone starts to mention block fees, we get very, very nervous, she said in an interview. We are waiting to see how that money is spent. We want input into how it's going to be spent. Ms. Wunsch also expressed skepticism about recent statements by Mr. Bentley that favored putting more money into collaborative law and other methods of resolving family law cases short of active litigation. This is not a new thing, she said. There are mediators in the family courts right now. If people thought they could resolve their cases that way, I can assure you that nobody wants to take their matters to trial. Hamilton Spectator, September 15th, Tuesday. St. Elizabeth case back in court. By Barbara Brown. The longest and most expensive civil case in Hamilton's history is back in court, with the St. Elizabeth Home Society appealing the 2005 dismissal of its $15.5 million defamation suit against the city and former region. The case goes back to 1994, when health officials of the former Hamilton-Wentworth region received letters from several staff members of the St. Elizabeth Villa alleging abuse of residents, mismanagement, and substandard care of residents. A confidential report on the matter reached the Health and Social Services Committee in April 1995. That report was leaked by a former city alderman to the Hamilton Spectator, which ran a series of articles about the allegations. But on December 13, 2005, Superior Court Justice David Crane released a 305-page judgment dismissing the action, ordering the society to pay the defendant's legal costs, which amounted to approximately $5 million. The society has cited numerous grounds of appeal, and arguments are expected to take a week. The case is being heard by a three-judge panel headed by Mr. Justice John Laskin in the Ontario Court of Appeal. Again, The Spectator, Thursday, September 10th. Opinion, Evelyn Myrie. In its first report since its recent restructuring, the Ontario Human Rights Commission acknowledges that much more work needs to be done on discrimination in housing, as this issue seems to come up time and time again. The report's focus on discrimination in housing brought old memories flooding back to my mind. The story goes like this. I called to inquire about an apartment that was advertised for rent in the local paper. When I called on the phone, the landlord enthusiastically declared its availability, but when I got there, his expression changed. It was no longer available. It's been rented. But I just called you less than 15 minutes ago, I tried to utter as he slammed the door shut in my face. I was devastated. This was not right, I thought to myself. Not believing a word the landlord said, I got home and called a college mate of mine who was white. She eagerly agreed to call the landlord herself and check to see if he was being truthful about being rented. Just as we thought, the apartment suddenly became available for her. She went to see it and made a deposit. And that was our proof. We went to the Ontario Human Rights Commission and filed a complaint. The landlord was fined. I later found another place to call home. Here in Hamilton, a consultation was held at the Ukrainian Catholic Church of the Resurrection. Groups and individuals had an opportunity to add their voice to the housing framework to guide the province for the next 10 years. The issues highlighted by the Human Rights Commission ought to be included in any plans put forward by the government. Also in The Spectator, Nicole McIntyre, Affordable Digs, part of City's Connaught Vision. The city's recommending the historic Royal Connaught be redeveloped for affordable housing. The hotel's owners are seeking more than $18 million in government assistance for the $27 million mixed-use project that would feature 100 units with rents 20% below market value, another 100 market-rate units, and 20,000 square feet of commercial space. Downtown Councillor Bob Bertina admits he's conflicted about the proposal, said wouldn't be his first choice for the 1916 landmark, but we can't leave that building empty forever. Tony Battaglia, spokesman for Grand Connaught Development Group Incorporated, said the plan represents the best chance of redevelopment. The reality is the marketplace is not very strong in the hotel sector, he said, noting a lack of financing. We don't want to keep the project sitting there without money. Battaglia said people's opinions will depend on how they view affordable housing. The units will be targeted toward the working poor. Downtown cores are made for all kinds of people, he said. Spectator Letters to the Editor by Melissa Dugid, Hamilton. Supportive housing shortage is unconscionable. Regarding Hamilton needs supportive housing, opinion September 2nd, and Give Voice to Local Housing Need, letter September 10th. Suppose that as a young adult you became physically disabled and lost the ability to dress and bathe without assistance. Imagine that you then learned your government-funded agencies, such as Participation House and the March of Dimes, to provide on-site 24-hour support in supportive housing that would provide you with 2 to 3 hours of assistance a day and on-call support when needed so that you could live independently. Then imagine that when you applied for this supportive housing, you were advised the waitlist is years long with hundreds of people ahead of you. In supportive housing, adults are able to live independently precisely because they are in charge of directing their support services depending when and how they're delivered. To live with independence is a fundamental human right. It's unconscionable that so many men and women are left without the supportive housing they need to live independently and with dignity. We must hold our government responsible for providing desperately needed supportive housing for people with disabilities. And in The Spectator once more, by Rachel DeLazer. Aldershot Pain Clinic put on hold. Plans to open a controversial pain management clinic in Aldershot are on hold, buying time for two more public meetings to address the issue of locating such a facility across from a school. At a Burlington Council meeting, Ward 1 Councillor Rick Craven asked that the routine approvals for the clinic's application be put through Council rather than the Planning Department. The report will now go to a public committee meeting and then on to Council in mid-October. Well-Beings is a pain management and dependency clinic that was set to open by November 1st. Plans are to locate the clinic in a heritage building at 444 Plains Road East across the street from Maplehurst Public School. Parents are upset the clinic will be so close to their children. About 300 residents filled a Burlington church to air concerns at a public meeting organized by Mary Dilley, school trustee for Wards 1 and 2. Dilley says it's not an issue of NIMBYism, but of locating the clinic in an appropriate location. I would love to see it located in the hospital or near the hospital. And again from the Spectator, penalized by geography. Cancer drugs are not available uniformly, by Cheryl Ublacher. Toronto, a patchwork system of coverage for cancer drugs across the country means patients are being denied equal access to life-saving treatments, says a report by the Canadian Cancer Society. The report, released recently, says patients in some provinces will have cancer drugs covered under comprehensive insurance plans, while those in other jurisdictions must pay some or all of the cost from their own pockets. And with most newer cancer drugs carrying price tags that can run into thousands of dollars, the burden of paying for life-saving treatments can mean financial disaster for some Canadians, the Society says. It's increasingly becoming the fact that your ability to get the drugs you need is dependent on where you live and how much money you have, said Dan DeMare, Director of National Public Issues for the Canadian Cancer Society. In our minds, that's not universal health care. The Society is calling on Ottawa to take the lead in developing catastrophic drug program in consultation with the provinces and territories, the insurance industry, and patient groups. Such a program is long overdue, the group says. Once a patient is discharged from hospital, the coverage varies widely from province to province. A BC resident, for instance, could have one of the newer cancer drugs fully paid for, while a patient in Ontario would have to ante up a portion of the cost, $2,700 a year, to get the same drug. Said PEI's Tracy Gaudette, her mother, a 72-year-old retired bus driver living on a fixed income of less than $20,000 a year, was prescribed the drug Sutent, but the medication's cost, $7,745 a month, was not covered by the province. Gaudette and her five siblings pooled their resources to pay for the first month's supply, and the community of Tignish held a fundraiser to help pay for subsequent prescriptions. But when her mother had a stroke in March, she had to stop the drug for 6 weeks until she regained her strength. By that time, it was too late. The cancer had spread, and her mother died in early May. I truly believe it had a lot to do with the stress she was put under, Gaudette said, because she wasn't concentrating on battling her disease. She was concentrating on the fact of the financial burden. And in the Globe and Mail, Vancouver, from Agence France-Presse. A psycho-oncological study says depression and cancer mortality are linked. Psychologists reported in the science journal Cancer that death rates from cancer were up to 25% higher in patients experiencing depressive symptoms and up to 39% higher in patients diagnosed with major or minor depression. In both of those groups, you can predict cancer mortality, said lead researcher Gillian Satin of the University of British Columbia. Ms. Satin said, "It would be my wish that this line of research fuels adding psychological social treatment into standard cancer care." Ms. Satin said that the researchers controlled for the chicken or egg factor. Do people become depressed because they are sick with cancer, or does cancer kill them more often when they have depression, independent of the cancer? "That's the million-dollar question," she said. "Even after correcting for that, we still see the positive relationship between depression predicting mortality." The published study said its goal was to determine whether empirical evidence supports the widespread belief by both the public and cancer specialists that a patient's state of mind affects the outcome of disease, although the mechanisms through which this might occur are under investigation. The field of psycho-oncology has experienced exponential growth, noted the study. 85% of cancer patients and 71.4% of oncologists endorse the belief that psychological variables affect cancer. Hamilton Spectator, Monday, September 14th. Tests show new flu drug works as well as Tamiflu. San Francisco. Research delivered a double dose of good news in the fight against flu. Successful tests of what could become the first new flu medicine in a decade, and the strongest evidence yet that such drugs save lives, not just shorten illness. A simple intravenous dose of the experimental drug Peramivir cleared up flu symptoms as well as 5 days of Tamiflu pills did, a large study in Asia found. An IV treatment is badly needed because many sick people can't swallow pills. Results were reported at an American Society for Microbiology conference in California. Treatment options are getting huge attention because it will take a month or more for people to get swine flu vaccine and have time to develop immunity from the shot. In the meantime, reports are coming in that swine flu is causing havoc in children and young adults. After a short week of schools being back in, we've seen a tremendous rise in cases, said Dr. Jonathan McCullers, an infectious diseases specialist at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. Globe and Mail, by Carolyn Alfonso in Toronto. One dose of H1N1 vaccine likely sufficient. Canada's order of 50 million units based on premise of two shots each. Canada's vaccine manufacturer says one dose, not two, of its new H1N1 drug offers enough protection from the pandemic influenza virus, which potentially means that the country may have ordered more vaccine than needed for its citizens. Results from GlaxoSmithKline's first clinical trials in Germany showed that 98% of healthy adults who received a shot containing 5.25 micrograms of antigen and the company's AS03 adjuvant, chemical boosters that can increase production, were protected from the virus when tested 3 weeks later. Early studies from the United States and elsewhere also show that one H1N1 dose may be enough, which would make the logistics of a mass vaccination program a lot easier than originally believed. When the virus first appeared, public health authorities worried that two doses, given about 3 weeks apart, would be needed to inoculate the public because H1N1 was a novel strain. With that in mind, Canada ordered 50 million doses from GlaxoSmithKline for all Canadians who want and need the vaccine. But another issue has to do with the amount of vaccine in a dose. GlaxoSmithKline plans to sell Canada a formulation containing 3.75 micrograms of antigen, less than what was used in the clinical trial, raising questions of whether the vaccine will work. Based on GlaxoSmithKline's experience with its adjuvant systems, we do not anticipate that there will be any significant difference in the immune response elicited by the final formulation, a company spokeswoman said. Scott Halperin, director of the Canadian Centre for Vaccinology in Halifax, when asked if Canada ordered too much vaccine, said, potentially. If further trials show only one dose is needed, the federal government may be able to change its order. If it's too late to do so, it may choose to donate vaccine to the developing world. Spectator Maria Babbage, no harmony over tax grab. The Ontario legislature returned with a fiery start as Premier Dalton McGuinty scrambled to douse opposition pyrotechnics over tax harmonization and spending scandals that have cast a gloomy pall on his fall agenda and a Toronto by-election later this week. Allegations of dirty tricks were hurled both inside and outside the chamber, with Revenue Minister John Wilkinson accusing the Tories of deliberately distorting the issue of tax harmonization ahead of Thursday's vote. Some of the Tory campaign material distributed to voters in the riding of St. Paul's is factually incorrect, he said after question period. Our candidates' opponents are only telling half the story, Wilkinson added. I've been looking at their material and the stuff that they've been putting on the web, and they are focusing on the HST to the exclusion of the entire tax reform package, which over the next 3 years is going to see over $15 billion worth of tax relief. Progressive Conservative leader Tim Hudak shot back, challenging Wilkinson to get off his butt and listen to what voters had to say. Even federal Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff, girding for a possible fall election, is opposed to tax harmonization, said NDP leader Andrea Horvath. The people of Ontario don't want this, and neither does the Premier's own party, the Hamilton Centre MPP told the legislature. Isn't it time just to take a step back now and consider some measures that will actually create jobs and leave money in people's pockets, instead of ignoring the needs and wishes of Ontarians and kicking them when they're down? And Monday, September 4th, in The Spectator, by Keith Leslie. Harmonized tax, expense abuses on fall agenda. Holding Ontario's Liberal government to account for spending and expense abuses and stopping the harmonization of the provincial sales tax with the GST will drive the opposition agenda in the fall session of the legislature starting this week. You will see us on Monday continuing to pursue the culture of entitlement that is set deep in the Dalton McGuinty government, said Progressive Conservative leader Tim Hudak, who is MPP for Niagara West Glanbrook. Under Dalton McGuinty's watch, we keep seeing scarce public resources being wasted on perks for well-connected insiders while services are being cut in hospitals and special education, said NDP leader Andrea Horvath, MPP for Hamilton Centre. We are really working hard to mobilize Ontarians against this tax, said Horvath. This is the wrong tax. It's the wrong time. And New Democrats are uniquely in lockstep federally and provincially in terms of our opposition to this tax. Horvath was taking a shot at Hudak, who admits he disagrees with his federal Conservative counterparts who are giving Ontario $4.3 billion to merge the two sales taxes into one 13% levy. One of our past interviewees has spoken Tuesday and Wednesday at the Capitol in Washington, D.C., against government health care's hostility towards the disabled. She will probably be back on our show in the near future to talk about that experience with you. And now to go out, blues boss Kenny Wayne, Portland Owls. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.